Kites filled the low, iron-gray sky. The schoolmen assembled before the interval's toll, even those who had patrolled the perimeter through the night. The cadres took to the air moments before breaking of dawn, so that they strode ablaze in morning gold above a dimmer world. Innumerable companies of knights and lancers and horse archers galloped out beneath them, scoring the immediate north and west with streamers of dust. The number sticks cast, the footmen marched into their wake. Tens of thousands watching in apprehension as the ochre smear of the horde climbed the circuit of the horizon and made a burial chamber of the sky. Never had so many felt so small. The schoolmen and the accompanying knights receded out of view. King Sesalam Rapather called the main host to a halt several watches after the ruins of Irsalor, a city destroyed long before the first apocalypse. Only mounds remained of the walls, a continuous series of embankments skirting the dead city's heights. Save for five decapitated pillars jutting from the summit, the fingers, the men began calling them, for the way they resembled a hand thrusting from some enormous burial mound, no structure survived the tidal earth. Staking his standard beneath the fingers, Unrapather watched the army of the south assemble across the heaped remains of Irsalor below him, the spearmen of Pradu and Invishi with their great shields of wicker, the Girgashi hillmen whose axes would flash in unison when they raised them in ritual brandishing, the levies of Nilnameshi bowmen arrayed in twinkling bars across the slopes, the famed Sarangi marines assembled in reserve, looking more like beetles than men with their round shields upon their backs. On and on, the dusky glory of the southern kings come to lands of pale-skinned legend. The buried bastions of Irsalor. And it seemed a miracle that out of all the indefensible lands they had crossed, they could find such a place, a strong place. How could he not think he had found more evidence of the whore's favor? He looked out across the desolate tracts to the shadow of the horde, to the dust plumes rising high and tawny above ochre gloom. Others in his retinue swore they could see the distant flash of sorcery. But he saw nothing. He bided his time and waited for tidings. Periodically he craned his head back to study the chapped bulk of the fingers looming about him, trying to guess at the figures worn into ambiguity across them. A man never knew where he might find portents and omens. He tried not to think of the souls who had raised the ancient pillars, or of their long-dead fate. From the beginning the question had been what the Shrank would do when the schoolmen cast their nets of light and destruction across them. Karandusu had argued that they would crash into themselves, fleeing mobs running into mobs, until they formed a crush from which none could escape. "I'll wager more will suffocate and drown than fall to our fury," the Grandmaster declared to the others. Of course, he admitted, some would survive the schoolmen and their fires, but they would provide little more than sport for the companies of cavalrymen riding the land behind the schoolmen. This did not happen. As Sicaris had urged weeks earlier, the Shrank were not beasts. For all the base savagery of their instincts, they were not so stupid as to flee into corners. Leading a great echelon of Nilnameshi knights, Prince Chirapatha watched the schoolmen wade into the boiling horizon. A thin line of glittering points stretched wider than his eyes could follow. And somehow he simply knew that Karandusu had been beguiled by his arrogance, that they had raised a spider-web about a dragon. Seized by this premonition, he commanded, to the outrage and astonishment of his men, that everyone shed their iron-scaled hauberks. Many refused, an extraordinary mutiny given the love and respect they bore their prince. Scattered across rising and falling swales of gutted land, the companies milled in argument and indecision. Chirapatha remained calm, simply repeated his order time and again. He understood the reluctance of his men. One after another, the glowing schoolmen vanished into the pluming sheets of dust. Lights flashed from the brown and black. The howling, which had keened as loud as always so close to the horde, warbled with unfamiliar resonances, then almost faded altogether. The Invidic knights watched astonished. Men famed for their bravery in the unification wars cried out in amazement and horror. More and more skilled hauberks clanked across the earth. The warring lights, if anything, increased in frequency and fury, until it seemed lightning itself walked the long rim of the world. The howling faded, and for several heartbeats they heard arcane shouts in the crotches of the breeze. The schoolmen, they had heard a different sound. Grim and slow building, chorus heaped atop, inhuman chorus, louder and louder, until horses reared and men shook their heads like fly-plagued dogs, until the air itself pricked their ears. Screams. Inhuman screams. The proud and headstrong knights of Invishi gazed out and instantly knew that the King General had erred, that his plan had gone catastrophically awry. For months they had shadowed the horde, watching the storm front of dust change color in accordance with the soil beneath their feet, and change shape in accordance with the strength and direction of the wind. Many times they had seen streamers break from the base and spill toward them like tumbling smoke, and always they had rejoiced at the prospect of running down isolate clans. But now they saw 100 such streamers racing toward them, 1,000, ribbons of dust blooming into high-drawn clouds of filth. Far from retreating from the crush of their fellows before the advancing sorcerers, the Shrank were running south. "Ride!" Prince Chirapatha bellowed through the cacophony. "Ride for your lives!" For some reason, Sorweel always took a deep breath beforehand, as if he were about to plunge into frigid waters. No matter how many leaps he suffered, a fraction of him always experienced it for the first time. Her arm hooked fast about his armored waist, her head a chalice brimming with singing light. And then the wrenching, at once violent enough to concuss the blood from his body, and as soft as wet tissue. The step across the illusion of space. The leap. But something went wrong. Meanings grasped too numbly. Utterances fumbled across a too weary tongue. Sorweel suffered the sense of not arriving all at once, as if his viscera trailed the shell of his body. He fell to his knees in the crest of what had been little more than a silhouette on the western horizon just moments before. He felt a sloshing barrel. Both Moengus and Serwa complained, but did not seem quite so unsettled as him. At last he spared himself the humiliation of vomiting while they watched. They all agreed to sleep. And so began the Horde's second assault upon the great ordeal. As the whip communicates the strength of the arm from the grip to the nail, so did the rush of those trapped against the river Irshi spread across the entirety of the Horde, from those hooked about Umrapathur's flanks to those massed near the Neliost coast. In the stark light of day they ran, numberless, maddened with hungers both vicious and foul, a shrieking plague. From his vantage at Irsilor, Umrapathur was among the first to realize that something was amiss. For so long the horde's roar, ringed of its resonance by distance, had sounded like an endless death rattle. When the sound faltered, he and the thousands of others had raised a ragged cheer, knowing that the schoolmen had begun reaping their arcane harvest. But the sound that climbed into its place, more shrill, like the fluting of winter winds, did not stop climbing. Higher and higher it roared, until men began batting their ears, and Sacel Umrapathur III, the first believer king of Nilnamesh, looked out to the dust fencing the horizon, and knew he had been deceived. He cried out warnings and instructions, horns brayed out against the building thunder. Out on the broken plain, only the most foolhardy of the grandees led their knights out against the Shrank as planned. Far and away, most realized, like Chirapatha, that something was amiss, but many tarried overlong in indecision, and were quickly overrun. The rest found themselves riding a great and desperate race. Ensconced in their deep formations, the infantrymen watched, with breathless horror, as more than 15,000 riders, Fleet skirmishers and ponderous knights rode scattered across the waste, throwing shields and cutting loose saddle packs, slapping blood from the rumps of their screaming ponies. Mountains of billowing dust roiled behind them, as if the world's very limits came crashing in pursuit. They watched company after company, strung out in panicked flight, engulfed in raving doom. They glimpsed shadows through the low ribbons of dust, skinny and vicious and innumerable. The skirmishers, like King Ermacthi and his fleet Girgashi, reached the ruined city in good order. Others, the heavily armored knights of Nilnamesh especially, were pulled under en masse. The more quick-witted commanders abandoned the flight and arrayed their men in defensive formations that lingered battling, pockets of frantic order engulfed in gibbering chaos, knights shouting and hacking, quilled in arrows, their positions dissolving like bright salt in putrid waters. Masar Abkaz Commandery, the youngest brother of the outlaw Fanail, and famed for severing his earlobe to demonstrate his determination to join the ordeal rather than remain as a figurehead in Nensophon, was felled by an iron-tipped javelin less than 100 paces from Irsalor's embankments. Prince Charapatha and his armorless knights, meanwhile, found themselves deflected westward time and again in his attempts to reach the besieged king. His captains had to restrain the prince, such was the violence of his grief. King Amrapathir watched the world and sky vanish behind the horde's veil. The air boomed with screeching until he could no longer hear his own plaintive commands. The horde closed upon Isilor, and they were naught but an isle in a shrieking sea. During this time, the schoolmen continued walking the skies to the north, raking and scorching the obscured earth. To a man they knew, Karandusu had erred, perhaps disastrously, but they had devised no means of communicating any alternative strategy. They could scarce see one another as it was. Eventually, the more decisive among them abandoned their northward course, and others followed, forming broken cohorts, whose passage back was marked with fire and light. Some became lost in the dust and would never find their way to Irsalor. Some, a few fools, continued northward oblivious and did not turn back until they passed beyond the northern rim of the dust clouds. None would return in time to counter the consult. Sheets of ochre were drawn across the sun, and shadow fell across the formations crowded upon the dead city. The strength threw themselves up the embankments and against the bristling ranks of men, who stood locked, shield to shield, shoulder to shoulder, as they had during the first battle. The horde caught about Irsalor as upon a jutting nail. The sons of Nilnamesh held the north and west, thrusting sword and spear between their cunning shields of wicker, nearly invulnerable in their gowns of plated iron. The vast bulk of them fought beneath the ancient standards of Ishdata, Erataka, Midaru, Invoira, and Sambati, the so-called five hosts of Nilnu, the tribal confederacies that had warred for the whole of Nilnamesh since time immemorial. Not since the days of Anzu Marapata II had so many sons of Nilnu marched beyond the padded plains of their home. Gone were the antique rivalries, the moral hatred that had so often set them against each other. Gone were the differences. And it seemed a thing of mad and tragic folly that men might raise arms against men, when creatures so vile so infested the world. The hetman of Girgash held the east, fierce mountain warriors come from their high fastnesses in the Hinayati, along with their softer cousins from Ajawe and the Vales. His horse abandoned, King Ermacthi stood at the fore of his countrymen, his standard raised in lieu of his voice. The grandees of Cayan held the south. The desert vicious men of Kianadini, as well as their taller brothers from Nensophon and Mungilia, all of them decked in their chained splendor of their father's fallen empire. Such was the clamor that they knew nothing of Prince Masser's fall, and so honored him with their courage. Crying out with soundless fury, the men of the south thrust and hacked at the gibbering masses. Even on the slopes, the inhuman ferocity of the assault Force those deep in the ranks to brace their shields against the backs of those before them, transforming phalanxes into singular structures of flesh, ligament, and bone. Missiles blackened the already shrouded sky, shafts that rattled without harm across the armored men, save those unfortunate few. The Kedai archers answered with great volleys of their own, laying low whole swathes of their foe. But with every draw they exposed themselves to the endless black rain, and their losses were grievous. Sorwill's eyes snapped open, the screeches of the viternal nesting ringing in his ears. He actually swatted the empty air immediately before him. So vivid was the image of a sun-burnished stork standing upon his chest. He sat up, blinking. They had leapt upon the treeless prow of a hill, so he could see immediately that he was alone. He could also see the surrounding sunlit miles, the creased terrain rendered as soft as ocean swells, for the woolen canopies that clothed it. A land like an old woman. He had fallen asleep on the shags of grass that edged the crude axe-blade of stone that capped the promontory. The shade had shifted while he had slept, so he could feel the sun's burn upon his cheeks and hands. His hauberk especially radiated heat. He peered into the adjacent gloom of the forest, blinking, searching for any sign of the Imperial siblings. A pang groped his breast when he realized their gear was missing as well. Had they abandoned him? He stood, shaking the fluff from his apparel, and the grogginess from his limbs. Then he wandered into the wooden regions, following the uncertain line of the summit, hoping to find his keepers. Hardened by the first battle of the Horde, the men of the south exacted a dreadful toll. When they looked out, they saw innumerable faces, wide and cats screaming, shrank and more shrank, wagging raucous arms, heaving across the basins below. When they looked back, they saw the ranks of men braced across the piled embankments, heights fenced in bright painted shields and bristling with spears, standards torn ragged by javelins and freighted with snagged arrows. And they remembered the words of their holy prophet, that they would see sights awesome and horrific, that they would suffer unimaginable trials, that they would save the world. And they believed. The Shrank were speared, and they were hammered. They were thrown from the Bedlam slopes, or pulled under by their howling kin. Soon the earth about the dead city was ramped with carcasses, to the point where many of the obscenities were simply trampled for want of footing, thrust stumbling and flailing into the spears and cudgels and swords above. Their screeching resounded from the very ribs of heaven. High beneath the fingers, King Amrapathor took heart, seeing that his host was too strongly situated to collapse, that it could only be ground to the nub. Soon, he reasoned, Sakaris and Karandusu would return, and with so many Shranks snagged upon Irsalor, mobbed to suffocation, the slaughter would be great. Given his vantage, he was among the first to glimpse the great blemish on the Horde's seething skin, an almond of black, marching beneath umber skies, moving slowly through the ghoulish fields of Shrank, driving ever closer to the beleaguered sons of Girgash. The hide of the mass was the first detail he could discern. The creatures composing it towered over the Shrank. Then he realized the blackness of the thing was due to hair. Great shaggy crowns upon heads like cauldrons. The fact of the creatures came to the king all at once, though his soul was long to comprehend their implication. Bashrag. Many saw their abominable approach, but like Amrapathor, all were powerless to communicate their horror and alarm. The Girgashi upon the embankment glimpsed them between frenzied assaults, hundreds of hideous frames rising above the Shrank, tossing below, an iron-armored formation, throwing and stamping the hordlings before them. Bashrag. Three arms welded into one, three ingrown chests, three hands for fingers. They were an offense to the eyes, a sight that awed and sickened, such was their deformity. Idiot faces hanging from each grotesque cheek, horse-tail moles springing from random skin. Amrapathur saw the nature of the consort trap instantly. Knowing the horde would turn and strike at the Irshi, they needed only to wait in ambush and hope their foe would be so foolish as to send out their schoolmen. The Believer King peered to the north, scanned the shrouded skies for sign of Sakaris or Karindusu. The abominations lurched ever closer. The surviving Gergashi bowmen found their range. They pelted the fell legion with arrows, and for a moment, Unrapathor dared hope. But the Bashrag advanced unscathed, quilled like porcupines. They climbed the slopes until they towered before the men of Gergash. King Ermakthi was among the first to be struck down, for he had stood at the fore of his kinsmen, his banner held high as a beacon to hearten his men. The Bashrag waded into their midst, sweeping their great axes and hammers. Shields were splintered, arms were shattered, heads were pulped. Whole bodies cartwheeled into the ranks behind. For all the courage of the hetman and their tribal vassals, they were no match for the creatures clacking and bellowing above them. They crumpled as foil and were scattered. Within 100 heartbeats, the Bashrag had seized the embankment summit, and Rapathur's heart caught. Only the Sarangi marines and their burnished shields stood between the beasts and his army's doom. Gilded in shining gold, King Eselas Mercidides led their rush, rammed his spear into the gullet of the foremost beast, only to be beaten to the quivered earth by the great hammer of another. But the famed marines did not falter. They threw themselves at the monstrosities, and a battle was fought, unlike any since the days of the ancient North. Fearless, skilled, armed with the finest weapons of Selukaran steel, the Sarangi stemmed the lumbering rush. But for heartbeats only. For every Bashrag they felled, dozens of their brothers perished. They were thrown, shattered, little more than sacks of human skin. Men mobilized everywhere through the tight-packed encampment. Priests, judges, water-bearers, the sick and the wounded. It did not matter. All came rushing. But the Bashrag swatted them dead. Men vanished beneath inhuman strokes. It was like witnessing a massacre of children. What followed happened so fast that those beneath the fingers could scarce believe. Innumerable shrank, scrambled through the breach wrought by the Bashrag, and shrieking masses of them spilled into the narrow ways behind the Inrithi phalanxes. To a man, the Zaldunyani had been trained to fight encircled, to form shield walls about them, and survive. And indeed some did precisely this, but panic seized many others, and men were felled in thousands. Amrapathur stood immobile, his gaze flinching from atrocity after atrocity. Men wailing in horror, men pulled down, grimacing, the fallen convulsing beneath rutting shadows. The pavilions and baggage trains vanished. Within heartbeats the entirety of the lower city was overrun, and those formations that did not fly apart or dissolve stood engulfed, dwindling lozenges of human form and color, in a threshing sea of monstrosities. Death came swirling down. The Nilnameshi Believer King gaped and stumbled. A stray arrow caught his hand and pierced the gauntlet. He raised his skewered palm in disbelief, saw the first of the schoolmen come striding on sheets of murdering light. Some solitary, some in ragged impromptu formations, motes pricked with brilliance, passing through clouds of missiles, dragging gowns of lightning-bright ruin across the horde. First dozens, then hundreds, schoolmen, hanging miraculous in the low sky, walking beneath mountainous scarps and troughs of dust. The whole north, it seemed, flared with sorcerous destruction. But it was too late. Men moaned in the dust. The world shrieked in inhuman triumph. So we walked through what seemed a peculiar fog, one that whined in his ears and yanked short his breath. The forest floor wheezed beneath his boots. Oaks and maples climbed high and mocking about him, splicing the sunlight. He heard them before he saw them. nearby. He stood breathless, listening to the creak and click of the surrounding woodland.
Yes.
A different kind of vigilance seized him, and he crept forward, peering between screens of undergrowth. His ears stood poised between the sounds of his approach and the passion that gasped through the skein of leaves. Like a thief, he crept. Seeing the devastation, the returning Mandati and Vocalati withdrew to the skies above the fingers, formed a ring of floating, battle-maddened brothers. Their faces blackened for dust and tears, they sang out their hatred in spite, the Mandate schoolmen wielding abstract architectures of light, and the Vocalati shining phantoms. And they burned those who clawed and clambered the slopes, and they burned those fornicating with the corpses of the fallen, and they burned those thronging through the multitudes. The slopes became fields of thrashing silhouettes. Sicarius turned to Karandusu and feared for the vacancy he glimpsed in the man's eyes. He bid his former rival to stand by his side, mouthing, "Let me know what it is, you shall win!" For nothing other than a gnosis was the prize the Aspect Emperor had offered the anagogic schools. But a monstrous wrath overcame the Grand Master of the Vocalati, the lunacy of one who cannot dwell apart from his pride. His was the name that would be immortalized for infamy. His was the name his kin would strike from their ancestor lists. He called out sorceries with savage abandon, lashed the ground with cruel fire, killing men and shrank alike. The survivors below cried out, stunned and appalled. Sicarius closed with the madman. To the horror of those watching, the two grandmasters battled above the inhuman multitudes, an exchange of wicked lights, abstractions against analogies. Overmatched, Karandusu was struck from the skies, undone. Not knowing what happened, several Vocalati assailed Sicarius, then several more, until fairly half of the Vocalati found themselves attacking for no reason, save that their brothers had so turned in violence. And so did the schools of Mandate and Vocalati consume each other in a final act of madness. The surviving men looked up from the looming fingers. At first they could not credit their eyes. They gazed dismayed and incredulous, while all about them the shrank surged up the smoking slopes. The frenzied creatures cast themselves upon the few hundred assembled against them, hacking and shrieking, a host that reached out to the obscured rim of the world. And bloodied King Cecil Amrapather saw that he was doomed. He fell to his knees and prayed that his holy prophet might prevail, that his beloved wife and many children might survive the horror to come. He looked up and saw a sorcerer falling, his billows ablaze. The shrank seized him, raped him, as he bled out his life remaining. Sorwheel could scarce breathe. His spit seemed gravel for swallowing. Two pale forms against depths of gray and water-green, the one slide upon, the one hard, locked in a clenching, quivering embrace. Kissing as though the other possessed the soul breath. Grinding, their groins famished, piercing and knowing. Never had he witnessed such a thing. Breath-stealing, filled with rage and horror and imperious lust. He was not who he was for seeing it. Not one of his concerns survived the trespass before him. Not his father. Not the tear of God that would avenge him. Nothing mattered save this. The children of a god mating. The woman he loved betraying. His little brother called out for him. He found him, grasped him, cold fingers opposite a burning palm. And he coupled with the sinuous image writhing before him, arched in answer to the man's black-haired grunting, spilled his seed to the girl's high blonde cries. The mounded heights of Usalor smoked and crawled. The schoolmen hung in the air above, raining death upon their wicked foe. They wept even as they spoke, hacking lights. For when they looked out, all creation whirled and seethed with foul shrank. And of the tens of thousands who had been their brothers, all were dead and desecrated. Shields trampled, corpses pierced, clotted with rutting forms like ants upon apple peels. The schoolmen scourged the embankments, pummeled the slopes, until Irsalor reared like a mountain burnt to the stub, sheeted and blasted, blackened dead. Man, shrank, Bashrag. And still the multitude surged forward. The horde reached out into obscurity, a cloak of twisting maggots thrown over the horizon, howling, howling. And the schoolman was so very alone. His crimson billows blacked for filth and fire. Sicarius descended, set foot upon the charred summit, in a heartbroken bid to recover Amrapather's body. But he could scarce distinguish shrank from man, let alone man from man. He looked out, over the tiers of smoking carcasses, through the comb of brilliant sorceries, out across the tumult of the plains, and it seemed he gazed upon the future. What would become of the world should his holy prophet fail? Raving, vicious, devoid of meaning or mercy. The schoolmen heard their prophet before they saw him, shouting arcana, in a voice like a thunderclap, the one voice that could shrug away the burden of the horde's roar. He came from the west, the Aspect Emperor, sparking a brilliant blue through miles of intervening filth. Where he walked the air, whole tracts of earth exploded beneath him, as though the god himself pummeled the powdered soil. Shrank were thrown in mangled thousands, flying hundreds of paces before raining across their inhuman brothers. Anacerimba Kellis came to them and bid them follow him home. She lowered her head to his chest in carnal exhaustion, and lay there, her breasts kissing the barrel of his chest, her back bent to the arc of an oyster shell. Sorweel stared, held motionless by the shock of his dwindling ardor. Shame, elation, terror. Knowledge that he could not move without alerting them robbed him of the ability to breathe. He stood, stupefied, as she turned to him and smiled. He ducked in abject panic and shame. "Who are we?" she called out in a drowsy laugh. "For you to abuse yourself so." He fumbled to fasten his breeches, then stood, knowing that the shadow of his lust could still be plainly seen. But it was almost as if their shamelessness demanded he be brazen in return. She climbed from her slack-limbed brother, stood in the dappled sunlight, entirely naked, and at one with the wilderness for it. How? How could she do this to me? Tears burned in his eyes. Did he love her? Was that it? Was the son of Harweel such an arrant fool? She stood, utterly exposed before him, her limbs lithe, her hips narrow, her pale skin flushed for the violence of her passion. Sunlight drew the shadow of her breasts across her white ribs, made golden filaments of her sex.
"Well?" she asked, smiling.
Indifferent, Moengus began dressing at leisure behind her. "But—" Sorweel heard himself cry like a fool. Her look was at once demure and arrogant. Moengus glanced darkly over a muscled shoulder.
"Your brother and sister," he blurted. "What you did is a...
He could only stand and stare at them incredulously.
"Who are you to judge us?" she cried, laughing. "We are the fruit of a far, far taller tree, Horse King."
For the first time he realized the derision and contempt they concealed in that name.
"And if you get pregnant?"
She frowned and smiled, and for the first time Sorweel realized that whatever warmth she had showed him was mere pantomime, that for all the human blood coursing through her veins, she was, and always would be, Dunyane.
"Then I fear my holy father would have you killed," she said. "Me? But I've done nothing. But you have witnessed, Sawweel. Your thigh is sticky for it, and that is far from nothing."
His breeches fastened, Moenga strode behind his sister, reached about her to place a scarred paw upon her womb. He kissed the hot of her neck, twiddled the fine blonde strands of her sex between finger and thumb. "She's right, Sawweel," he said, grinning as if entirely oblivious to the madness between them. "People have a habit of dying around us." The Sekarpai king stood squinting against his turmoil. His heart pumped outrage instead of blood.
"As do nations," he spat before turning on his heel. "A son!" the Grand Mistress of the Swayali called out after him, her voice mellow and bewitching. "A son! A daughter! And an enemy!"
He fairly convulsed, so violent was the shaking that overcame him. It racked him all the way back to their camp on the promontory. He found himself fearing the drops beyond the edges. Never had he been so shamed, so humiliated. Never had he hated with such dark intensity. Though the great ordeal survived, though their inhuman enemy had been thrown back to the rim of the horizon, the second battle of the Horde was nothing less than a disaster. The Holy Aspect Emperor declared the breaking of the ordeal undone, and commanded the armies of the West and the East to converge upon the army of the Middle North. None of the believer kings doubted his decision, even though this most recent defeat of the Horde had increased the opportunities for forage. King Cecil Unrapathur, one of their number, was dead, as were his kinsmen and vassals. They felt his ruin keenly, for he had breathed as they had breathed, ruled as they had ruled, and most importantly, believed as they believed. If they did not understand as much before, they appreciated the grim truth now. Their faith was no surety. "The righteous," King Proyas would remind his fellows, "bleed no less than the wicked." The armies gathered without fanfare or celebration, for the men of the Circumfix were too hungry and astonished, and there were far too many absences among them. A pall had been drawn across the hosts, a shadow immune to the arid sun. Old friends were reunited in grief and lamentation. They traded stories of Irsalor between them, and the truth suffered little for the inevitable distortions. They had witnessed events so extreme as to outrun the possibility of exaggeration. They had come to a land called Akirsual. In times of old it had been a frontier province of Cunieri, sparsely populated, famed only for a hill called Swaranol, which rose solitary and inexplicable above broken floodplains. Swaranol was a place holy to the ancient High Nosarai, for it was here that the gods had come to the chieftains of their many tribes and granted them tenure for all the lands within 1,000 leagues. The Holy Aspect Emperor called on his believer kings to assemble and to follow him. Climbing broken and overgrown steps, he brought them to the summit of Swaranol, into the pillared ruins of the Hyalas, and stood so they could see the great ordeal spread across the alluvial plains below. And though their losses had been grievous, the tents and pavilions of the combined host still embroidered the land to the horizon. Arms and armor winked in the sunlight, so that it seemed diamonds had been scattered across the whole earth. And they took no little heart in this vision of their glory. Prince Chirapatha was there, and many were the condolences extended to him. Sicaris, however, stood alone and brooding, shunned because of his rumored fratricide. The Holy Aspect Emperor opened wide his haloed hands. The lords of the ordeal turned to him in reverence and sorrow. "I have delivered you to the waste," he said, the resonances of his voice cupping heart and ear alike. "And now even the stoutest hearts among you fear I have brought you to your doom. For though I warned you of the strength, described for you the immensity of their number and the cunning of our enemies' machinations, you find yourselves dismayed. several called out in contradiction, and a cacophony of warlike declarations reverberated through the temple ruins. The Aspect Emperor silenced them with a glowing palm. "They are the filings, and we are the lodestone. Were we to concentrate, march ranks closed along the shores of Nulliost. They would come. Were we to scatter across the high Istuli's desolate heart, they would come. It matters not what path we take. It matters not what we do. The Shrank will come and come, and we will be forced to destroy them." Like ethereal fingers, the intonations of his voice stretched wide, then concentrated, to better seize the passions of his congregation, and to hold them. "Irsalor," he said, breathing horror into the name, "Irsalor is the very proof of our greater peril. A dozen ordeals could march as we have marched, slaughter as we have slaughtered, and still the Shrank would not be exhausted. Were the No-God to awaken, they would be seized by a single dark and malicious will, and for all its might and glory, mankind would be doomed. The very world," he said, balancing existence upon an outstretched hand, "would be given over to wretchedness and rutting darkness." Laments climbed into a ragged chorus. "So what are we to do?" King Sauban called out. "We thirst, and are sickened for drinking, and we hunger, until our shoulders are naught but hooks, and our axes and cudgels grow heavy with our frailty. We have stumbled with Irsalor. Now we stagger." These words provoked consternation among many of the believer kings, for they thought such doubts an insult to Sauban's exalted station. "Stay your impertinence," the bellicose King Hogrim called out in reproach. "No," the Holy Aspect Emperor said to the long-bearded king, "we must speak plainly. Only honesty provides truth. Only truth delivers triumph." He stepped into their midst, placed his blessed hand first upon Hogrim's shoulder, then upon Sauban's forearm. "As many of you have surmised," he said, "I have deceived you as to our stores, saying we had less when we had more. I have starved you so that our rations would carry us as far as possible." "So what are we to do?" King Sauban called out yet again. More shouts climbed from the assembly, this time in discord, for as many called out in assent as against the exalt general's presumption. The clamor wilted in the light of their holy prophet's sad smile. "Scavenge what strength you will," he said, striding from their midst to reclaim the ritual heights. "Ponder your wives, your children. Ponder your soul. Fear not the specter of thirst, for soon the Nulliost, the misty sea, will heave dark before us. And fear not starvation." He turned, taking two pillars as his frame, and the enormity of the great ordeal as his beyond, the hundreds of thousands streaming and milling across all that could be seen. He burned as a beacon before it. The breeze trilled through the plaited flax of his beard. The shoots of his gown swayed. "To suffer is to bear evil," he said, "and we must suffer to see our world saved. No matter where it delivers us, what madness, what evil, we must follow the shortest path!" The Holy Aspect Emperor of the Three Seas walked, luminous among the doubtful and afraid. He acknowledged each of them with the simple, loving profundity of his gaze. He gave them heart even as he appalled them, for they understood what he was about to say, the truth they dared not whisper even in solitude. "Henceforth, our very foe shall sustain us." The dread command had been given at long last. "Henceforth, we eat Shrank."